financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Raham.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Raham. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I am good. I'm rearing to go today. What are we talking about?
Well, I mean, it's in the news is in the weather all the time right now about the hurricanes and people in North Carolina and Florida that are really hit by these things. And certainly our heart goes out to everybody that's struggling with this. But I think we need to talk about donations, charitable donations that are legit and ones that are not, and how to do the research and tell the difference. Even the people who are in those areas who have been hit by hurricanes are experiencing challenges trying to sort out whether it's a legitimate contractor asking for their money or it's not. This is just the worst of the worst. When you know, they say don't kick somebody when they're down. This is when false charities come out of the woodwork and when unscrupulous people start to take deposits to do work on your home and they're not ever going to show up and they just take your money and abscond with it. Everybody's quick to blame the insurance companies immediately. And I think they, you know, they can handle their share of blame. But what I want to talk about, at least in the first part of the show today, is how to do a little research and make sure that you are donating to the right places and that your donation is, in fact, tax deductible if it's a real charitable location. And for people on the ground, a few things they can do to find a reputable contractor, because everybody's scrambling. And the first thing they tell you, I mean, I have clients in both these states, right? And the first thing they'll tell you is, but it's so hard to get somebody. And we can't get the insurance money until we hire the people and they give us a quote. And it's just round and round and round about trying to get someone to repair the damage and what they start off quoting and what they end up charging. And it really turns out to be a lot like, well, let's just say it, blackmail, right? A lot like extortion. Yeah. And to that end, I will say that I received a letter we'll talk about in the second half probably of this show that really read like an extortion letter. It had threats, lots of threats. And I will share this language with people because I want them to recognize if they get an email like this, it's like the old-fashioned chain letters were. So we'll talk about that too. But first, let's talk about the poor people that have been hit by hurricane or flood or some other disaster and what's going on in those areas in terms of scammers, right? Scammers.
Yeah, I will say I think we're talking about two different things. So I just want to separate them. I've been covering a lot of what's going on in Asheville, North Carolina. So there are two different things. There are big organizations that you think that if you're donating to, say, a United Way or a Beloved Asheville or whatever the name of it is, making sure that that's a legitimate charity versus then contractors too, which is a different thing that you have to worry about scams. But what's really sad is that even officials in Buncombe County, which is where Asheville is, are having to take time out of their daily pressings where they're recovering bodies and all of that to warn people to not fall for these scams. So it's happening there right now as we speak.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And as you know, this show, although we do it on WHMP radio, right, it gets published across the country on public access stations everywhere. And I actually have a client in Asheville who I've not been able to reach. I've called her and called her. I haven't been able to reach her. So Max, if you're listening and you hear this, please call Frances. Please call me and let me know that you're okay. She's a brave sort of woman who would chase bears off of her porch with brooms and things while I was on the phone with her. You know, she's a tough woman, but I just hope that she's okay. So there are two different things. Let's talk about the contractor thing first. I think it's the easiest to sort out of this. The thing that preys on people the most is your emotions, right? Your emotions are what's going to cause you to make a knee-jerk decision. And it's the same in this letter I was telling you about with the threats, right? You want to act quickly to save yourself from something. And because contractors are so overloaded, people have a sense that they're not going to be able to get their place repaired. And the longer it stays unrepaired, the more damage is done. And so the insurance companies love to say you need to mitigate damage or we're not going to pay for additional damage. How do you mitigate damage if you can't get a contractor? So the local contractors that people know and trust are busy instantly. If they're not in trouble themselves. So what happens is contractors come in from other states. Oh, there's an opportunity to go do work here. Now, they may be legitimate contractors. You may get your work done. And they may just be people who show up and give you a good quote and are good schmoozers. And they say, I require half up front and half later or a deposit up front. You give them money. You never hear from them again.
And it happens so often.
It happens really often. And unfortunately, because the insurance companies pay you usually as by reimbursing you, it's usually your money that you gave out of pocket to pay somebody.
Yeah.
So the very first thing I want you to do is talk to your insurance company. When somebody comes to give you a quote or before they come to give you a quote, call the insurance company and say, do you have a list of reputable contractors in my area that I can trust to do this work? And many insurance companies will. They won't recommend somebody, but they'll have a list. Okay, these are the people that we know of that we've worked with in the past. They're legitimate. If you get a quote from them, you know, we're going to probably pay your claim based on that quote. What's really hard is people that show up and they say, okay, so here's a good way to catch this scam. Somebody shows up in your driveway or on your property and they say, I can see your property's badly damaged. We've been up the road doing work on another damaged property, which, you know, they're not going to tell you exactly where it was and you're not going to be able to check it out, but it's always this kind of story or often, you know, we've been doing work up the road on this property and we get a lot of leftover siding, leftover shingles, can't use them. I mean, as long as you don't mind black shingles on your house, we can give you a great discount.
This reminds me of the show we did on the pavement where they were trying to pave the driveways with the extra
You remember that?
And it was a total scam.
Total scam. That's right. And so, you know, gee, it's a great discount, but we got to use up the materials. We don't want to drag it back to the store. We bought it and can't return it. There's some excuse as to why they have some way to help you out.
And it's real hard to return a paved driveway after you get it done when they're trying to charge you more.
You know what? In the end, because we helped that guy ended up with a free paved driveway.
Oh,
because they couldn't take his pavement back and we weren't going to agree to pay him, right?
But oh, good.
We paid for him and that was it. And as far as I know, nobody else got scammed after that. So that was a good outcome. But, you know, it's so difficult for people, especially if you've got something like a leaky roof. What do you do with a leaky roof? You've got to mitigate that damage. So start by calling your insurance company and say, is there some list of contractors? Now, one of the best pieces of advice I can give you if you have an insurance claim like this is to maybe contact a private insurance adjuster. Now, most people don't know this exists. We've done a show where we've had one of these people on as a guest.
Yeah.
Private insurance adjuster, just look them up in what used to be the Yellow Pages, right? Go Google them, whatever. Call your state and say who's licensed as a private insurance adjuster here. And talk to them. Their job is to go to bat for you. They will likely have contractors in your area who not only that you can trust, but that they will work with to get you the best prices, to get the most money out of the insurance company, because they make money based on your insurance claim. So rather than charge you up front, although some will charge you up front for consultation, but they'll have a clean contract. You can look at the contract and say, okay, I'm going to pay a consultation fee. But for the most part, these guys go to bat for you, men and women, go to bat for you, and they take a part of the cut. But they do their job. Now, some are better than others, as always. But you want to talk about taking a load of stress off your shoulders? Think about just call a private insurance adjuster and say, here's what's going on with my property. What do you think you can help me with? And find out. They will be overloaded too. And they will want to try and help you. So you might have to be a little patient. But when things like this happen, I know the gentleman that we had on the show, Rick, he is in areas like he lives in North Carolina. So when this kind of thing happens, he'll be up day and night, he and his wife, just processing claims, trying to get, you know, quotes on houses, doing tests that the insurance agents wouldn't have done, the insurance adjusters wouldn't do, like is there moisture in your walls, things like that. So it's really worthwhile to do that for contractors.
We didn't talk about this before, but what would you say if you go about that? How much should you spend on an insurance adjuster? How much is too much to spend on that?
Well, different adjusters will charge you different percentages, but most of them work on, say, a 10 or 20%, usually 10% cut of what your insurance company is paying you. And they usually get your claim up there because they do all these tests and prove all this stuff and they go to bat rather than the insurance company sending out an adjuster who feels like they work for you, but whose job is really to give you a quote on the repair of the house. But face it, if they don't work well for the insurance company, they're not going to get many of these gigs. So,
yeah.
You know, it's not that they're completely, you know, unobjective, but get somebody on your side. You know, it doesn't cost you anything to get a consult from these people usually.
Okay. What I was going to ask you, though, is like for an insurance adjuster, say they take 10%. Does that mean that out of your pocket, you got to pay 10%? Or does that mean that they find a contractor that will take 90% of what the insurance pays and they take the 10%?
Oh, interesting.
Does that make sense?
No. It's sort of, yes, but no, the contractors are going to get paid the full amount. The insurance company is going to pay a full claim, and the adjuster is going to take 10% of the claim.
Okay, so that's not you out of pocket.
Well, I mean, you can look at it that way if you want, but no, it's not out of pocket up front. So let's say the insurance adjuster comes in and says, look, the damage to your house looks like it's about $65,000.
Mm-hmm.
Private adjuster, and sometimes they're called public adjusters, may come in and say, $65,000, are you kidding me? You have a policy limit of $250,000, and I'm looking at damage here that I think is going to be $150,000 easy. And they go to bat and they negotiate with the insurance company. And
they're
they say,
more
look,
money.
Yes, up to the
Got
policy
it.
limit. And so
okay.
Based on that, they take 10%. It's in their best interest to negotiate as high as they can for a claim
mm-hmm.
because they're getting 10% of it. Meanwhile, you are probably going to make out a lot better financially. And I know the insurance companies will hate me for saying this, but, and you know, it's a little bit of stress off your mind. You got a professional to help you. This is the way things work. I know how the system works. Let's do this. Okay.
And if you go with an insurance adjuster from the insurance company, chances are they're going to be erring on the side of the insurance company.
It's tough to say. I mean, I
yeah.
had a claim here once on my own and they sent out a wonderful adjuster. And
mm-hmm.
I did not get the sense that she was trying to cut corners at all. In fact,
okay.
I remember her standing in my hallway and saying to the person on the phone at the insurance company who was arguing with her these exact words. I don't think you understand. This woman has no children and her house is white. We will pay. Quote, unquote, we will pay. So not all insurance adjusters are heartless, you know, people. But I think it's always good to have somebody on your side if you can, because the other claim I had was in North Carolina, and I'd been hit by a hurricane with a house at the beach and couldn't
Oh,
get
wow.
one of the policies to pay anything. I mean, it was really a disaster. And one of the policies said, you have $1,200 of damage. $1,200.
Oh.
I mean, all the siding was off the house. It was
Yeah.
insane. And the insurance adjuster was able to go to bat, get the claim done, get the house sided. And I'm 800 miles away. So that was a private adjuster that solved that
Yeah.
problem. And I think it's worth thinking about. So we should, consider that, but we should talk about the charities and this extortion letter I got so that people know what to watch out for and where to do a little research about these things too.
All right. First of all, let's get your phone number.
Certainly. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, coming up on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi, Jess. Thanks for staying with me on this. I got on kind of a rant about contractors, but I think it's just so important for people who are, you know, have damage to their property that they know how they can get some help and try not to get taken advantage of by unscrupulous
mm-hmm.
people. On the other side of the coin, however, are the people that are kind-hearted that want to help them out by donating some time
right.
or some money. For the most part, people who are donating their time are doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Donating money is a great thing if you can afford to do it and you want to help people in a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you need to make sure that you are donating to a reputable organization because scammers are very cunning. We talk about this all the time. They know exactly
mm-hmm.
how to get money out of your pocket. And when yeah. there is an emotional disaster, a natural disaster or some sort of emotional thing where people are in trouble, then they tend to, scammers tend to hit first, believe it or not, seniors. They get their lists out of seniors. And
I know, it's awful. It's just
they
awful.
They go after people with Social Security checks living on fixed incomes, right? And then they just go down the line. I mean, and today with the internet and all the things that they can do, robots and AI, they've run amok. You know, even the robocalls, even if you get a person, never mind a robot, they can cloak their phone number so it looks like somebody in your local area.
Right.
I mean, how many times have you picked up the phone? You think it's somebody you know, and it's some telemarketer, and there's this pause before the person comes on the line, and then they want to scam you, and they will always tug on your emotions. They'll always be vague about how your money is going to be donated. They won't give you specifics, you know, what your donations are going to do. They'll be vague. They'll be sentimental. Gee, thank you so much for helping us out. Sometimes they will call you and say, we really appreciate your previous donation, which you never made, right? Mm-hmm. And we're just asking you to donate again to our charity. Now, if you get somebody on the phone who is busy or confused or donates to a lot of different charities, they may not recognize whether they made that donation or they don't. So they say, oh, yeah, this is the same place I donated to last week. Okay, yeah, I'll give you a little more money. And it's not the same place at all.
Would you advise to not donate if someone calls you up, like cold calls you, and go instead to an actual legitimate website that you type into your browser?
I absolutely would advise that. And you would think by now that everybody would know this. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, when you get somebody on the phone who looks and sounds, you know, who sounds like they're from your local
legit
area.
Yeah.
And they have your local area code and they're talking away at you and they're, how's your day today? Oh, you're so fortunate. You know, we are blessed. We're better than, I mean, I've heard all the pitches, right? You know,
it's easy to get sucked in. Yeah. Easy to get sucked in. And also if you're an older person, you're happy to have like someone calling to talk to you and chat. And
some older people, some are very, very busy and, you know, don't have time to talk. I heard a great line in a movie the other day. Somebody called them at home and they didn't want to be called. And they said, would you mind giving me your home phone number? And the person said, no, I'm not giving you my home phone number. And they said, ah, that's probably because you don't want people to call you at home, right? Now you know how I feel.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. So anyway, you know, they'll cloak their number. They'll use names that sound like a legitimate charity. They won't stumble like I'm doing right now talking. But there'll be some bogus organization. And maybe they'll even claim that your deduction is tax deductible. I mean, your donation is tax deductible. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Your donation isn't going to be tax deductible if you pay it to a bogus company.
Right.
So you need to do some research. If they're doing something like guaranteeing you a sweepstakes entry, that's not only a scam, it's illegal. They can't guarantee that you're going to win a sweepstakes if you donate to this charity. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one thing you can do. First of all, I want you to report this stuff. You can report it to reportfraud.ftc.gov. And if you're looking for your state charity regulator, it's NASCONET, NASCONET.org. So you could go right there. Hey, you know, somebody calls you and what you do is you say, hey, I'm sorry, I don't donate without checking up on you. Give me your charity name. And then you go to NASCONET.org and you look
them up. You'll probably realize, too, if they quickly get off the phone after that.
Yeah, but, you know, they've gotten really tenacious, Jess. People have reported to me that they said no, 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 and the people just kept at them. But wait,
so they don't scare off easily.
Yeah, until finally, some people will pay money to get them off the phone because they feel agitated. You know, okay. All right, $20. I'll give you $20. You know, and then they go away. So you certainly do not want to give them cash. You do not want to pay them online, and you do not want to send them a cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to donate to any charity, a legitimate charity will take a check or a credit card. My recommendation is to put a credit card in the middle. And then if there's a problem, you can call your credit card company and say, I have a problem with this charge. I don't think it was legit. And the credit card company will erase the charge for you, right?
Okay.
Okay. Places you can research: BBB, Charity Navigator, Charity Watch, Candid, FTC. I mean, your attorney general's office, that NASCONET I was telling you about, you name it, you can research there. If you want, there's a great report that the FTC puts out called Donating Through Crowdfunding, Social Media, and Fundraising Platforms. And just go to FTC.gov, type in charity scams, and you'll come up with that. Okay. So please, please, please do that kind of thing. Now, I promised you.
I want to hear about this letter. Yes.
Oh my gosh. So I won't show it completely on the air because it has some of my information on it, but it came to me in an email looking like this, complete with a picture.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's it?
The picture is supposed to be my address. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about this letter. All right. First of all, the beginning paragraph, the opening paragraph is bolded, a clear sign that it has been tacked on to a typical scam letter. All right.
Okay.
It starts with my name, not my first name, my first and last name, comma.
Okay.
Who addresses a letter? It's clearly sent out by an email poster, you know, and it doesn't have an email address you can chase. It's got a string for an email address in it. You can't chase it, and it's not signed. So if you look, if you try to research it, it's just some scammer's email that's here today, gone tomorrow. They used a temporary email address, like the kind I use when I'm buying something and I don't want to give up my email. And then it's gone in 15 minutes. So you're not going to find these people, right? Okay. Here's after the paragraph that says, I know that calling you, and they list my phone number, or visiting, and they list my address, would be a convenient way to reach you if you don't act. Threat number one, first sentence. This is a convenient way to reach you.
If you don't get back to them, they're going to show up. And they have a picture, which seems a little stalkerish.
Oh, you aren't kidding. Okay. Don't even try to escape from this is the second line. You have no idea what I'm capable of in, and they put your town in. This reminds me of those old Mad Libs when we were little kids and we would fill in the blank, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I won't read this whole letter to you, but there are some important points. It's important you pay attention. Also, the grammar is not the best. It's important you pay attention to this message right now. Okay, here's that sense of urgency we talk about. Take a moment to chill and breathe, right? Here's the emotion, okay? And analyze it thoroughly. We're talking about something serious here. And I ain't playing games, all right?
I didn't think this letter was going to be so threatening.
Oh, it's bad. You do not know anything about me, however, I know you, and you must be thinking, how, right? Then they go on to say, you've been browsing the internet, and you've been treading on thin ice, I'm paraphrasing here, and you've been stumbling across some not-so-safe sites. All right, now who hasn't stumbled across some site they didn't mean to go to, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, I actually placed a malware on a website. There's more detail than I'm giving here. On a website which you accessed. And now I've been, while you were watching these videos, I was able to start operating your device as a remote device. And now I can look at everything on your screen, flick on your camera and mic, and you wouldn't have a clue.
Ooh.
Oh, and I've got access to all your emails, contacts, and social media accounts too. Now, there's three more threatening paragraphs. And finally, it gets to the point. And the point is, transfer amount. $1,950 to my Bitcoin address.
Okay? Wow.
Followed by, once you pay up, you'll sleep like a baby. And my favorite part of this letter, I keep my word.
Oh, now, is this something you go to the police over, or is this just a Better
Good
Business
luck.
Bureau?
Good luck. The saddest part about this is, you know, I've been to the police about things like this in the past. They can't trace it. They're busy, you know, doing hard crimes that they can catch in their own town. So, yes, I reported it to the Federal Trade Commission. Yes, I reported it to the Better Business Bureau. Yes, I said it was a scam email and block it for the future. But, you know, this one in particular was pretty bad because there really wasn't much of a way to trace it. I'm a pretty good techie and, you know, you can be chasing your tail for a long time here.
That seemed super aggressive, too, by the way. I mean, I can just imagine, like, you have a certain kind of personality. So you saw it, you knew what it was about. But I could see somebody getting that and not, and really it's scaring them.
It's awful because you know what I did? I read it, printed it out, wrote radio on the top of it and said, oh, I'm so going on
I'm
gonna
save it for
this.
Yeah.
So good.
So did they just, like, Google a picture of your address, do you think, to get the picture?
Oh, yeah. We're not done yet.
Okay.
So now says, after the once you pay up, you'll sleep like a baby, I keep my word, it says notice. colon, in bold letters. You got one day to sort this out, and I will only accept Bitcoin. I have a specific pixel in this email message, and right now I've been notified that you've read through this email. This email and the Bitcoin address are custom made for you, and they actually have the nerve to use the word untraceable in the letter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it's untraceable if you send somebody Bitcoin. That's the point of Bitcoin. Do not send Bitcoin. Then it goes on to say, if you're not familiar with Bitcoin, you can Google it and you can find a Bitcoin ATM in your neighborhood. There's no point in replying to this email or negotiating. My price point is fixed. Let's see. Once you pay me, you know, you'll sleep like a baby. And then it says, as soon as you send the complete payment, my system will inform me and I will wipe out all the dirt I got on you.
Where are you supposed to send the payment to? And is that traceable?
No, it's not traceable. It's a Bitcoin address. So they give you this string.
Bitcoin address. Okay.
It's a Bitcoin address. And they give you this string that's, you know, a million characters long, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, if I suspect, they go back to threats. If I suspect that you shared or discussed this message with someone else, your video, apparently that they've taken, will start getting sent to your contacts, and I will post a physical tape to all your neighborhood next week. What? This thing's just coming off the wheels by this point, right? And don't even think about turning off your phone or resetting it to factory settings. It's pointless. I don't make mistakes. And they tack my name on again. Okay. Then they post a picture, which no doubt, if you have my address, you can get a picture of the street. It's not close. It's not my house. It's several houses up and across the street. They post a picture of it and they say, see you here? Question mark. Mm. Then, honestly, those online tips about covering your camera aren't as useless as they seem. Now I'm waiting for my payment. They are still waiting for their payment, I might add. I mean, what the heck are you thinking? Yet, $1,950 is very specific. There's a lot of threat in there. If you happen to be somebody who might be looking at websites you shouldn't be looking at, you're going to say, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, they got something here, right? You know, I have a little camera thing on all my devices. They don't know that. It's just a mm-hmm. little plastic thing. You just slide it over when you don't want to be on camera. So they don't know that I have that. So they're saying, oh, you better get one of these camera things. But I know I have it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get an email and it sounds anything like that, do not give them any money. Definitely do not give money through Bitcoin. I'm sorry, but Bitcoin exists to not be traceable. It reminds me of the show we did with the man, Edward, who got taken for $4,000 because somebody mm-hmm. called him and said that they were calling from my Boston office.
Yes.
And he had to go buy gift cards, and he did it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, stop. Think. Here's my closing quote on this. If you are thinking about making a financial decision and you feel your emotions bubble up, mm-hmm. step away. Nothing will happen to you by backing up for a moment and thinking calmly and doing a little research. And there's a lot of danger that can come from you acting impulsively.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's especially hard with charities because you want to feel good. And the people on the ends of the phone or in the emails do what they can to help you feel good while they're taking your money from you.
Right.
So do not let them separate you from your money, and definitely don't do it with Bitcoin.
Well, if you get a letter like that, or if you have any other questions, what phone number can they call you at?
Okay. No Bitcoin, no cryptocurrency, no gift cards, checks, credit cards. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I am good. You are recovering from a little bit of a cold.
Yeah. Well, a sinus infection, unfortunately.
Your voice still sounds great, though. Yeah, not much, though. It's almost sounds perfect.
Thank you. What are you driving these days?
I mean, I'm going back and forth on whether I trade it in or not. I'm an older BMW. And it's a really cute little car, but it's time to go in, but I just don't want a car payment.
What year?
BMW. It's 2015.
It's not quite old enough for what I'm looking for this segment, but it's getting close.
What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about classic cars as an investment.
Okay.
And BMW happens to be one of the ones that's gaining in popularity, but we're talking about early 2000s. For BMWs, but there are lots of other things to pay attention to. There was a great article where there was an interview from Hagerty. Hagerty is a classic car insurer, and they know a lot about classic cars. And the thing that I found most fascinating about it, well, there were lots of interesting things, but the thing I found most fascinating is that when you think of classic cars, mm-hmm. we think of baby boomers, right? Where's all the money? Baby boomers have all the money. They're buying those 50s, 60s muscle cars, right? Dodges and things. So the Charger, whatever. And it turns out that now it's millennials and Gen Zers that have the high interest in buying classic cars.
Oh, that's surprising.
It's a little surprising. It's sort of a matter of economics. If you think about mm-hmm. it, in 2008 financial crisis, right? After that, the job market, it was anybody's guess. I mean, people were worried about just affording their car, never mind whether they liked it or they wanted to buy a fun car, right? They were mm-hmm. just worried about affording it. But, 15 years after that, plenty of money is hanging around. And guess who's got it? The millennials and the Gen Zers. And there are a number of reasons that they might be interested in buying collectible cars as an investment. And this is quite far from the kinds of things that we normally talk about on this show, right? We talk about investments in annuities and investments in, other kinds of products that you might expect, CDs and other kinds of financial products and securities.
Yeah.
But in terms of hard investments, people often ask me about real estate. Is real estate a good investment? Blah, 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 right? But almost nobody asks me about cars, yet they buy cars. And I think the idea is that I will say a car is a bad investment. It loses money.
When you first brought this up, that's exactly what I thought you would think, because you always hear that as soon as you drive off a lot, it depreciates. Now, I know a classic car would be different, but you have to throw a lot of money into that, right?
Well, it depends on the car. And that's part of the appeal of these, dare I call them, newer classic cars. We're talking about late 80s, early 90s.
So sad that that's an older car now, a classic.
Well, I mean, even into the early 2000s. Still classics. Now, people who know me know I love cars, right? One of my partners used to say that I romanticized cars. I gave them names and I like to drive them. And it's really true. I really like cars, but I don't see them as an investment typically.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's draw the line here. All right. The most expensive car sold in 2023 at auction was sold at the Sotheby's Paris auction. For a little over what would equate to $10 million today.
Wow. What kind of car was that?
That was, let me see, a Bugatti. It was a one-of-a-kind Bugatti Profilet.
Oh, makes sense.
Chiron Profilet. So it sold for 9,792,500 euros.
Wouldn't you be scared to ever drive that?
I guess you
don't buy it to drive it, but yeah.
Okay. So now there's a lesson. If you're just getting into this, or if you're thinking, hey, I might like to buy a car as an investment, and mm-hmm. and you're trying to rationalize that with your partner or just with yourself, right? Buy what you like. Buy something that's fun. Don't worry so much about it going up in value. I say this to people when they talk about, should they buy gold or silver, or should they buy Bitcoin, or what should, everybody's concerned about what will I buy that I'm guaranteed it will go up in value. And thank you for playing. It doesn't work like that. Certainly not in the classic car market. There are some things that you can pretty much rest assured are probably going to go up in value, like that Chiron, right? But $10 million, you know, I mean,
yeah,
people getting into this don't have that kind of money. What they could be looking for is something that they have an interest in that is fun, that they would like to maybe drive, let's say, to car shows, right? That maybe they register, if it's old enough to be an antique, they can register and pay 1/7 of the insurance and only drive it on Sundays or to car shows, right? So there's a way to keep your costs down a little bit about this. One of the things you could do to keep your costs down is do your research. Can you get parts for these things? How readily available are they? Can you get them at reasonable prices? Who's going to do the work on this car when it breaks or in order to get it ready for a car show or for resale? So this might digress a little bit, but I've already confessed that I like cars. And in my garage right now is a 2005 Jaguar S-Type and a 2005 Mini Cooper S convertible.
Now, do you ever drive those?
I drive them all the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the Mini Cooper S convertible, I actually purchased new, knowing that I would never drive it in the winter. It's never seen salt or a snowflake. It's in perfect condition. But I take it out when once they sweep the streets, when they sweep the streets, that's my clue for, okay, I can take the convertible out for a drive. Now, clearly, I have to be able to afford to do this. If this was a stretch for me, if I were talking to a client and this was a stretch, or they had other things they needed to spend their money on, I would say, don't do it, right? So the Jaguar I bought used, and I bought it just in March of this year. But I wanted a little background here. I had a rotator cuff problem, and driving the Cooper was, you know, it's a more tactile, you know, sports car kind of drive. You're really stuck to the road, but every little bump moves the wheel. And it's a standard. And I was just feeling it in my shoulder. And I thought, I've got to do something different, either park it, or maybe it's time for me to buy some sort of luxury sedan. So when I looked at luxury sedans, I looked at all kinds of things. Jaguar S-Type turned my head. Now, mechanics will tell you, you didn't make a smart purchase. It's not maybe the most reliable of the cars. You're going to spend money repairing it. They will leak oil. They will do these things. Okay, to me, that's almost part of the charm. The fact that the English would rather have beautiful burled wood on the dashboard than to get the electronics right, as I think there was a movie quote somewhere, excuse me, that's part of its charm, believe it or not, to me. I don't expect to sell it for three times what I bought it for. I love driving the car. It's a beautiful car. It was a special order, radiance red, cream-colored interior. Had 73,000 miles on it. It's an 05. That's like 3,500 miles a year. Okay.
Yeah. It was somebody's baby. Yeah.
It was a one owner. The guy was 93 years old and he was going into a facility and his friend was helping him sell the car. I had it looked at. I have a good mechanic. I'm fine with that. It's not my daily driver. I mean, if something is wrong with it, recently I parked it for 2 weeks while I drove my Toyota RAV4, which is my daily driver, right? So this is the kind of story that you'll hear from car collectors across the country or across the world. They have something they rely on every day to drive back and forth to work. They can't afford and don't want to put the miles on their classic cars. But, you know, even those two cars are a little new to quite be collectible classics, but I'm aging and so are they.
Yeah.
And they are in pristine condition.
It seems like there's two ways to look at this with classic car collectors. One's an emotional decision and one's more financial. So the emotional one would be you've got two cars that you love driving and you take them out at specific times, but you're not expecting a big return. If you are expecting a big return, what should you do? Should you be looking for a car you're never going to drive and you're just going to park it?
Well, first of all, I think you'd be hard pressed to separate the emotion from the financial part when it comes to a classic car.
Okay.
Even people with deep pockets buy stuff that they have a fondness of, you know. Oh, I remember when my father used to drive us here in this car and I want one of those and I can afford to buy it and I'm going to buy the best one I can buy.
Right.
Maybe they drive it, maybe they don't. There was a local person, I won't mention him by name, but people will know who he was. Avid car collector. I mean, huge garage with really spectacular automobiles. Somebody was paid to just take care of the automobiles. That was their job, right? But when he wanted to drive one, he could drive it, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, what would I recommend? I would recommend what I said. Buy something that you like.
Mm-hmm.
Hope that it goes up in value. Do your research. You know, I'll give you some examples of things that Haggerty's thought on Haggerty. Haggerty puts out a bull market list every year.
Okay.
Their 2025 list isn't out yet, but it'll probably be out soon, I think. But the 2024 list highlighted some things like 1980s Lamborghini Countaches.
Okay.
That might cost you some money to buy, but also 2000 era BMW M3s. All right. Oh, she says.
Maybe I'm hanging on to this. Rewind for 1 second. For those of us who don't know, what is a bull market list?
Oh, it's a list of things that you think are a good buying opportunity.
Okay.
All right. A bear market list would say hold back, don't necessarily buy, maybe sell. Okay.
Okay.
But bull market list is I'm buying it with the hope that it's going up in value.
Okay.
Maybe even the expectation that it has a good chance of going up in value. A surprise on that list might have been the Plymouth Prowler.
Oh, I don't even remember that car. Yeah, I don't remember that.
It was a late 90s car. And the key here is they may go up in value. Haggerty isn't saying, look, if you look at our list, buy something here and it's going to be worth three times its value tomorrow. It's here's what we think might increase in value. They also recommend, you know, what's his name? McKeel Haggerty recommends don't buy cars only as an investment. And I would say the same thing. You know, those two cars I talked about, I don't think they're the best investment in the world. I didn't buy them because I thought they would be an investment. I bought them because they spoke to me. You know, each car is very different from the other. Here's another little background. And I'm sorry to give you so much background on this, folks, but, you know, I just want you to understand when I'm talking about this topic, it's not that I'm an expert in the field. I'm just like you. If you're a car enthusiast, I'm just like you. My very first car that I remember actually putting together myself, you know, and mm-hmm. registering and saying, this is my car, not something my parents gave me to drive, was a 1960 Sunbeam Alpine.
Oh,
now,
I
it
love
was
that.
old. If you think, how old is she? It was old when I built it, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't the Tiger. I couldn't really afford to build a Tiger. A Tiger was... Think Maxwell Smart. If you ever saw a Maxwell Smart movie where he drove up in that little tiny British sports car with little fins on the back. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like an Alpine, but they chopped off the fins and they stuffed a 289 engine in it.
Oh.
And it screamed down the road and they called it the Tiger. I could not afford, nor would my parents probably have approved
Let you.
of building
Yeah.
a Tiger. But a 1960 Alpine I could build. And I got all the jokes you can imagine when I would go for parts. That's a Sunbeam. Wait, isn't that my razor I shaved with this morning? That's a car. You know, I would get it all. Again, it was part of the charm. But I built it from three parts cars with two good mechanics who were close friends who helped me for almost no money. And I mean, I was right in there, hands on, greased up to my elbows, loving every minute of it. And that's probably where I got my real start in, you know, I love cars. I love cars with round headlights. Now, you talk about an emotional or silly reason to buy a car. I really like the look of round headlights. I like round, smooth lines. I recently, when I was car shopping, thought about a Tesla. And I loved the outside look of the Tesla, but I didn't like the inside look. It didn't seem old enough for me. I'm a throwback when it comes to cars, you know.
Yeah, it's very techy on the inside of the Teslas.
It is, and that's part of their charm, but it wasn't for me. And so if you're looking at classic cars, we're going to talk to you a lot more, of course, about this, but thanks for letting me share my stories.
Well, let's get your phone number if people have questions maybe about investing in cars.
Oh boy, can't wait for this one. 413-773-3333.
You can also go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be right back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. We're talking about classic cars as investments.
We are. It so makes me want to go out for a drive, though. You know, beautiful weather, clear roads. We have a beautiful area to drive in around here and see the sights. And it's just to go back to those, the three vehicles sitting in my garage. If you think the money doctor has three vehicles, how good can she be with money? I'm just going to tell you, when I talk to people about money, it isn't about hoarding every penny. Money to me is a means to an end. Now, that doesn't mean you should blow it all and try and end up broke by the time you're 65, right? But there's a balance. There's a certain amount of money that you earn that can go for things that maybe someone else thinks is frivolous, but which pleases you, which makes you happy. That might be taking care of your grandchildren. It might be buying real estate. It might be traveling. It might be classic cars. But it's your money to do with what you want to. I'm just trying to help you help give some guidance as to if this speaks to you, if what you want to do is buy a classic car and you can afford it, not just afford to buy it, afford to repair it, afford to insure it, afford to let it sit undriven for who knows how much time. Basically, when people are buying classic cars and we're not sure they're going to go up in value, which is most people who buy classic cars, or go up in value enough, I would say give you caution in two areas. One is it only matters if it goes up in value if you plan to sell it. This is the same argument that we have about real estate when people say to me, part of my assets for retirement is my house. I have a lot of equity in my house. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to sell your house? And if so, are you going to have to spend that equity to buy the next house? Or are you going to live in it? Or are you going to take a reverse mortgage or something like that? Well, it's the same with cars. I don't want to hear about why you bought it because it's going up to three times its value unless you're going to extract that value in some way. Otherwise, I'm just happy you could afford it. You got a car you loved. Maybe you'll trade it for another car you love someday. But one of the things that appeals to people about this kind of an investment, as opposed to monetary investments that are non-tangible, is that these people meet. There's a society of car enthusiasts, and they race cars sometimes. They go to car shows, right? They have events. There was just a fundraiser event that my sister went to. Ironically, there was a funny coincidence here, who has a car show once a year to raise money for a rescue league for pets. And they raised $14,000 for it in one day.
You see it all the time, especially in all the small towns. There's always car shows like every Saturday. I see them all the time. And then you see the long line of the classic cars driving by you. And I love that. I don't mind slowing down for that because it's so cool to see like the old Model Ts and like you said, some of the revved up sports cars. But I like the old, like the Model Ts and stuff.
Yeah. One of the things I like about this, Jess, is the individuality of it. You know, you don't go to one of these car shows. I think Tom's Hot Dogs has a long history in Hatfield of having a car show as well. But if you go to that, you don't see, you know, here's all the Plymouths lined up. Here's all the Fords lined up. You will see a vast variety of cars and you'll see people who dress like their cars or who wear costumes from the period. I mean, people get into this.
It's a whole community.
Yeah, it's a community. Another thing people like to do is they go to what we call swap meets or parts fairs where you can walk around and find that wheel for your 1942 Hudson or whatever it was, you know. And so there's a certain involvement in this, a personal touch to it that draws people in and makes them perhaps more interested in this as an investment as something else. I just want to caution you, no investment should take all of your money. This is an opportunity to diversify into something that you like to drive or care to own for some reason, and it may increase your portfolio in value. There's some interesting stats that we always like to tell you about stats so that, you know, I'm not just pulling this out of my hat, you know, hey, I like cars. Let's talk about cars today, right? Although, oh boy, Click and Clack. Oh my gosh. I used to love that show. They cracked me up. But anyway, Yahoo Finance did a survey and they found that 75% of Gen Zers said that they loved or liked to drive. Now, this flies in the face of the fact that people say, oh, Gen Zers, they don't even want to get their licenses. They take an Uber everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, it isn't quite true. Now, that may also have something to do with economics, right? They're making more money, all of that. But it's really the baby boomers who drove that collector market, that large collector market, up to a new level. But Gen Zers and millennials now are the ones out there fishing for cars. In fact, they did a survey on 40% of the people responded. And of those 47% of the people, Gen Zers, 60% of them said they had an interest in buying a classic car. Now, those are people born between 97 and 2012, right?
Okay.
Baby boomers, only 31% of them said they had an interest in buying a classic car.
Do we think that Gen Zers have an interest in it because they all moved home with mommy and daddy and now they can afford it?
Well, let me tell you. Okay, here's my tough love money doctor moment. If you're living on mommy and daddy's couch and you buy a classic car and they let you do it, my brain rattles around in my head. This is for excess money. This is for money that you can afford to not recoup. If you, at least at the lower levels, at the levels we're talking about, 80s, 90s, 2000, you know, what do we say, BMW M3s and things. If you can afford to buy this and maybe be wrong, maybe it doesn't increase in value, then I think that's an okay buy for you and you want to do it, that's fine. I'm the perfect example of I probably would get my money out. Oh, here's another tip. Buy it right if you can get a great deal. Now, I shudder to tell you what I paid for that Jaguar. And it certainly wasn't because I was taking advantage of somebody. It was because the opportunity just popped right into my hands. I mean, yeah, I was looking around going, yeah, maybe some luxury sedan. How about this? How about that? No, I don't want to pay that much money. You know, I looked at Maserati. Now, you would think Maserati,
oh, wow.
Here's a perfect example. You would think Maserati would cost you a fortune, be way out of the reach of most people. There were used Maseratis in the same age range as the Jag, you know, $12,000-$13,000, sometimes $9,500. It's got the Maserati name on it. But my research led me to believe, oh, no, you don't want that one, because if it just needs brakes, it's $3,500, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever. So you have to not just look at the name and the car, but what the cost of upkeep is, because if you let it run down, as I said, these two are in pristine condition and I keep them that way, right?
Right.
If you let it run down, then you have a problem. Now, that being said, I want to talk to you about car repair for just a moment, again, from personal experience. I had a problem with the air conditioning in the Jag. Now, I could pay $1,500 to $1,800 to repair the air conditioning if I took it to one mechanic and they just said, this is what's wrong, or I could take a different route. Now,
okay,
you have
what'd you
to
do?
Be able, well, for right now, the air conditioning isn't working, to tell you the truth, because I don't need the air conditioning working at the moment, but I have found a route to repair it for much less money. But you have to be willing to do those kinds of things and think about it as a monetary expense or investment. So, for instance, my initial comment was, wait a minute, I only paid this much for the car, you know. If I put that much into it, I will have overpaid for this car. I will have put more money into it than it's worth on the market. And because it's not a safety issue, it's not a mechanical issue, and I don't have this car as a straight investment, I just say, you know what, for this year, I'm going to roll down the windows or drive the convertible. What do I care if this doesn't have air conditioning at the moment?
Right.
It's a harder decision. You want to put it in perfect condition. You want it to always, you know, you want to always keep it in pristine condition. But I watch out for these emotional rationalizations, like, this is my baby, so I'm going to do it. Now, when it needed brakes, you betcha, I'm going to do it. If it needs something that, like oil, there's an oil leak, I'm going to do it, because that has to do with the health of the car.
And maintaining the value of it.
That's right, maintaining the value and its longevity and my ability to drive it happily and safely.
Yeah.
Those things are going to take precedence. But the other things that are sort of fluff, you know, if you want to put blue LED lights under your car, you need to think about how much you're increasing your cost basis. While we're in investment world here, let me use an investment term. How much your cost basis has increased, and are you able to get your money out of that if you sell it? If not, then what you're paying for is a hobby. And that's okay. Again, if you can afford it, if you and your partner are in agreement and it's not causing a major, you know, row in your world, okay, then you call it a hobby and you throw money at it. But for a serious car enthusiast, a serious investor, you will keep track of your expenses and your cost basis on that vehicle and know what you can get out of it if you have to sell it today, tomorrow, the next day.
Well, two really important things that I think you said are research and having a good mechanic. You know, research that you're not overpaying it to begin with, but then also finding a mechanic that you trust that will lead you in the right direction where you might be able to do this repair and not do this other major one and still maintain the value. But finding a good mechanic is like number one.
Well, it is number one, but I will say that sometimes you start out trusting a mechanic. They build a relationship with you. Maybe something changes in the back or, you know, or something changes for them. And now they start to, now they know they've got your trust and they're starting to say, well, I think you should do this, that, and the next thing. Again, we go back to research. For just about any classic car, there are forums everywhere. You get on the internet, you find a forum. I learned a lot about the Jag before I bought it in forums where people said, you know, you read the same messages over and over again. Hey, you know, air conditioning might be a problem, or this might be a problem, or that might be a problem. You're not going to find, most often, you're not going to find a car that is perfect for everything. I looked at a Lexus. Lexus was one of the cars I considered, and they were pricier. And I thought at first, well, maybe they're pricier because they need less repairs, but I found the repairs to be just as costly. And I didn't, and the particular kind of Lexus I was looking at, I didn't find one I loved. And so I just moved on to another brand. I kicked a lot of tires, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when that Jag opportunity, you know, I wasn't in a rush to do it. And that's what I'm saying to car enthusiasts too. Look, if this is something you want, it's not your daily driver. You don't have to do it today. Spend the time, enjoy the research. You know, I test drove a number of different models and kinds of cars. I talked to people, I talked to mechanics about them. I called two or three mechanics and said, if I'm looking for a luxury sedan, maybe in this price range, what would you recommend? And they gave me opinions. And that's how I know. Some people said, well, I don't, the Jaguar S type, I don't know, but it'll be okay if it doesn't have these things, you know, and they give you some parameters. And I think that's always worth looking at. So just like anything else, do your research, ask people, don't trust blindly. You know, if you're looking at a car, ask if it's okay to bring it to your mechanic and have it gone over before you pay for the car and make sure that you're getting something that is sound and that you're going to appreciate and you're not buying a lemon. Or
and I can imagine, yeah, I can imagine if they balk at that, then there's probably a red flag. They don't want you to bring it to your mechanic.
Yeah, I think there should be some way for you to at least get your mechanic to look at the records that are there. I wouldn't just trust a Carfax on these things. They're older cars. You know, these cars were around before Carfax was. So,
yeah, true. You know.
All right, get somebody knowledgeable to help you. Yeah.
And what is your phone number if somebody wants to give you a call to ask some questions about this or anything else financial?
Sure. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
And as always, you can go to hugyourmoney.com. This was fun today.
Thanks. I had fun too.
All right. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com. Would you like to see your business on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor? We offer a 15-year proven track record. We have limited openings, but are currently seeking sponsors and guests. Is your business a good fit? We'd like to start a conversation. Contact us today at 413-773-3333 or info@hugyourmoney.com.